It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The connection between reliable sources of energy and global prosperity and security has been profoundly impacting countries since the Industrial Revolution. And as dependent as we in the United States are on oil, a shift away from petroleum-based energy could dramatically impact our economy and way of life. So how are countries shaping their economic strategies to factor in their energy needs? That's a question our next guest is looking into. James Clad serves as a consultant to energy and investment firms and is the Distinguished Research Fellow at the National Defense University. He previously served as the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Asian and Pacific Security Affairs. And Mr. Clad is in Pittsburgh to address a World Affairs Council of Pittsburgh public policy discussion and luncheon tomorrow on the geopolitics of energy. The program will begin at noon at the Rivers Club in Pittsburgh. He joins us now in Studio A. James Clad, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you very much, Paul. It's great to be in Pittsburgh.
And if you'd like to join our discussion on the geopolitics of energy and call in with your questions and comments, our number is 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Our email address is esspgh@wesa.fm. And you can reach us on Twitter at esspgh and follow the conversation at #EPLive. James Clad, let's begin by having you explain the geopolitics of energy, what it means, and why people should pay attention to it.
Well, it's a big question. If you got 20 hours, it'd probably get me started.
I wish.
I think every time you look at politics out there, and I spent about 25 years outside the country working in Asia and Africa, again and again you intersect with issues relating directly or indirectly to energy. And, of course, there's no shortage of geopoliticians and strategic types in Washington who will always be talking about interdiction in the Straits of Hormuz coming out of the Persian Gulf and the Straits of Malacca. And it attracts a lot of people who are interested in kind of political chess and chessboard games. But the real truth is it is what is the inextricable part of the contemporary economy. The contemporary economy is more, not less, energy intensive. Even the electrification of our country with all of the iPhones and screens and things that we're using is proceeding intensely, so that energy demand in this country just for power is going about 3 or 4% a year. So it's inescapable with our contemporary life.
And the history of the geopolitics of energy impacting global prosperity and security, it goes back all the way to the Industrial Revolution.
Even before it, if you look at it, I mean, energy would largely define how a society worked, how fast it was able to get around. When it was sail power, obviously things were limited, sail and horsepower. But with the, you know, steam engine, the number of ways in which people were able to increase mobility, railways, that type of thing. So I guess what I'm really doing is saying energy is inextricably a part of a contemporary society at any time, but it really took off, obviously, with the development of hydrocarbons beginning in the late 19th century. And, of course, what's quintessentially American about these United States, which is our devotion to the private automobile. And all of the contemporary things that are looking at new ways to power these cars are really looking at a perpetuation of motor car ownership and use.
For over a century now, as you say, the United States has been reliant on oil. So how does the disruption of oil markets impact us?
Well, you really asked a good question, Paul. One of the things that people say is, well, look, now with shale oil and shale gas being exploited, aren't we at a point where we're looking at surplus and therefore we can have a type of self-sufficiency and maybe we can reduce our dependency on these very difficult places like the Middle East or Venezuelan supply, this type of thing? But the truth is, even with really great increases in production of resource from this very recently exploited resource, thanks to some technological innovations, you still, if you have a good crisis in the Strait of Hormuz, something over Iran, something bad happens in Nigeria or Venezuela, you're right back to high prices, which are driven by, obviously, people looking at an opportunity to put a bit of a squeeze on the market. So it shouldn't be assumed that just because we're entering into energy abundance, and by the way, abundance is now, it's here, it's happening today. It's not something that we're looking forward to. But even in this environment, which is giving us new headway and new autonomy in the world, we still have real problems out there with the old-fashioned issues.
Right. And we've seen how there can be a disruption, or how a disruption of oil markets impacts us. We saw it in the 70s with the long gas lines. We've seen it since with long gas lines after Katrina. The situations that we find ourselves in tend to make people wonder, and I'm wondering if you wonder about why, since 1905, with all the things that have changed technologically in the world, cars still run on gas. The U.S. is still and still has not been able to find a workable alternative to oil.
You've asked a terrific question, and by the way, this isn't just an American answer. It's a global answer. And the thing which recurrently comes to mind when I ponder the same question is that petroleum-based economies are very mobile, very agile, reliance on private vehicles. I was in the Peace Corps in Africa, riding Land Rovers and various things to the back of beyond. It was the type of thing which would lend itself to being able to get from A to B without having to sort of invest in enormous infrastructure. The World Bank just last week announced this big new initiative to help countries like Indonesia and Pakistan, places that may be rich potentially in solar and wind power, to begin to develop and exploit that. But again and again, you do the numbers, and it requires such a commitment, a capital, upfront commitment to change things, that people are content with relying on variations of the hydrocarbon economy. And that's really what the world is at right now still. It's not a world that's saying we can't change, but it's a world saying let's supplement our energy sources in other ways rather than pushing back oil and gas.
Right, and we've talked about doing it in this country for years, and for whatever reason it hasn't happened. There's been some exploration of alternative energy, renewable fuels, but the leap of faith that needs to happen in terms of the investment you just talked about, it hasn't happened. Why is that?
Well, Paul, I wouldn't be so gloomy. I think a lot of things are happening, and they happen in areas that don't generally get much limelight. The efficiency, you mentioned the 1970s. If you compare the motor car of today with what existed 40 years ago, I mean, you're looking at incredible changes, and not just the rate at which you can go a certain distance on a gallon of gasoline, but really the way the engine works, the way in which the whole hydraulic system works. I mean, they're boring, if you get into there and want to talk about this for an hour straight, but it's actually really interesting relating to the way in which we do more with less. We are having in this country a reduction in carbon emissions. It's happening because there's and I know this affects a lot of people in Pennsylvania, a reduction in a number of committed coal power stations. So all in all, the picture is very flexible. It's in flux. But I'm generally quite optimistic about the future of oil and gas. And then one last point, natural gas looks increasingly set to be what they call the bridge fuel of the future, enabling us to buy time and continue to power our economy at a time when solar and wind and some of the other renewables will be much more reliable and can fill a larger space. That's my view.
President Obama has said it's more than a bridge. I'm trying to remember the term that he used, but he indicated something far more substantial than just a bridge.
Well, he sees it as such an important thing arriving on the horizon now to augment American competitiveness. A lot of people think, oh, well, we have all this stuff, so we don't need to export it, and we're finally self-reliant. To use a fancy word, this is called mercantilism. It means you got stuff, whether it's gold, that's what drove the Spanish 3 or 4 centuries ago. What sort of drives a lot of the Chinese now with their policies on, refusing to export rare earth elements, this kind of thing. But the truth is that it's a global economy and American competitive position. One of the things that's never talked about is the improvement to the merchandise account. Our country is always spending more in government services, the fiscal deficit from government. But the merchandise account deficit, which is a fancy way of saying do we export more than we import or vice versa, has been running against us for something like 25 years. That's changing as well, and not in a small way due to the fact that we're developing these resources. And these resources are eliciting calls for American expertise, and that's sold abroad as well.
It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is James Clad, who serves as a consultant to energy and investment firms and is the Distinguished Research Fellow at the National Defense University. He previously served as the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Asian and Pacific Security Affairs. Let's look at what occurred in the news yesterday. President Obama announced the Climate Action Plan for cutting carbon pollution. Does that signify a potentially significant shift?
Well, I think the president, you know, obviously is answerable to many constituencies, and the environmental people are highly mobilized and highly motivated, and they feel that this is, represents a gesture, and some people think a rather belated gesture by the president in that direction, particularly with the disappointments of carbon trade that didn't seem to go anywhere in the first administration of the president. The announcement doesn't carry any strict timetable. There will be new guidelines issued and all the rest of it. So don't expect the world to change tomorrow. But more generally, I think it's beginning to be more acculturated within the United States that the carbon emissions thing reflects our own improvement of internal efficiencies. And I think the move to natural gas is part of this. Unfortunately, it does seem to be a kind of public policy echo of the change toward, at least away from coal. And it seems to me that that just reinforces a trend that's already there.
And obviously, proponents of coal are upset about this. Others who criticize the president's plan say that we can cut our carbon emissions, but if China and India and other countries aren't doing it, then what difference does it make?
Well, in a broad sense, because it's a global world, not just in economic interrelationships, but because, you know, we're breathing the same air. I mean, the acid rain that's falling on Japan comes over from China. It's very proximate and very real. And as a personal point of view, I believe that China and India have just about played out this argument that they're the developing world and they don't have to go along with an increasing consensus. I think it's untenable, and I think their own middle class is choking in pollutants. I mean, I've got some pictures to show the World Affairs Council people tomorrow. They'll absolutely make your hair stand on end. There's now a reason for them to start getting serious, and we're seeing that also in the energy market, where demand for LNG, which is much cleaner to burn, obviously, and keeps the cities from having to get so polluted. We're seeing that in China and India really skyrocketing.
My guest, James Clad, again, he serves as a consultant to energy and investment firms and is the Distinguished Research Fellow at the National Defense University. He is our guest. We will continue our conversation and take your calls at 412-246-2002. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is James Clad, who serves as a consultant to energy and investment firms and is the Distinguished Research Fellow at the National Defense University. He previously served as the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Asian and Pacific Security Affairs. He's speaking to the World Affairs Council of Pittsburgh tomorrow. We'll give you more details about that before we wrap up. You were a war correspondent in Asia. You also covered the 1980s Iran-Iraq war, and you were in Iraq in April of 2003,
yes,
shortly after the U.S. secured victory with shock and awe.
Yes,
critics
was.
In the U.S. and other parts of the world called this a war for oil. How much did the abundance of oil in Iraq impact our strategy there, if at all?
You know, I'm in the throes of writing a book because I feel sometimes you've got to let time go by and resist the instincts for a quickie book. Also, of course, I was in government and all the rest of it. But I had a very privileged place from the very beginning, working as a detailee to the White House, and left in June 2003, returned again from time to time. The reason for mentioning this is that, in all honesty, the oil factor was very, very low in people's priorities. I think that we mismanaged a great deal almost from the very beginning of our arrival there. But the idea that the war was motivated by a desire to have Americans in a privileged place to have access to Iraq's oil, or that somehow we paid special attention to making sure that happened after we had arrived. I just don't believe it. It just didn't happen. Many people feel, including a recent article in the New York Times, that the prime beneficiary, if you're looking at flags out there doing well, is the Chinese.
You mentioned the book that you're writing, Wasting the Golden Hour in America's Iraq Meltdown, and the first chapter appeared as a piece in the National Interest. And as you look back on the Iraq War, as many are doing now 10 years after, and chronicled what you cited as the missteps after our victory there, what would you say were the significant ones?
Well, the piece appears in the current issue of the National Interest, and it was something unlike anything I'd written in my career in Washington, where you get into kind of a pattern, you crank out the usual policy stuff. We use the word wonk there, which is no spelled backwards. and there's a sense of the conoscenti, and we're all so clever, and we talk about strategic issues. But I remember being struck, particularly as I had been a war correspondent, and I'd seen a lot of very tough stuff along the way in different wars that didn't get much play in the U.S., including the Iran-Iraq War, where 1.5 million people died, mostly in trench warfare type things that were reminiscent of the First World War. But I was struck by how we were going in without any sense of history of the place. We went in, and this is the great attractive feature of our country. We wanted to go in and change it for the better, but we went in very ignorant of the way it worked and really indifferent to the fact that the clock was ticking from the very moment we arrived and we had very little time to do anything.
Some people feel that by getting back to the issue of energy, that by focusing on green energy, we can avoid wars. And this may be a simplistic view, but what are your thoughts about it?
It's something I've given a fair bit of thought about, and I know that there's a sort of seductive ease of reaching a conclusion that says because oil drives the sinews of the world economy and because this place, many places like it, represent choke points where you can get a hold of supply and dictate things, that somehow this drives aggressiveness. I think there's a bit of truth in it, but I can't believe for a moment that we would run out of reasons to fight one another if we were all living in a green economy. I just don't see it, unfortunately, as probable. Many people have been looking for single answers to the question of why people fight and do cruel things to one another, and I don't think it's about oil.
So there's that key question hanging out there. How deeply could a shift away from petroleum-based energy, how could it alter global politics?
I think it already is. I mean, again, we mustn't talk about this, you know, as a future conditional.
It's
happening now in big and little ways. For example, the Russians have relied on exports of gas. I mean, people forget that Russia is largely a kind of one-product economy, in this case, like Saudi Arabia, petroleum and gas. And the fact that the Europeans might now have more choices than just to accept whatever Gazprom pipes to them from Russia is affecting Russian leverage and Russian power and influence in Europe today. This is happening right now. Secondly, countries that thought that they might be entirely resource poor and were doomed, like, say, Japan, under any scenario, Japan is going to import 100% of its fuel, that they were doomed, like Japan, are now discovering that they have shale deposits that could be exploited and are turning to American firms for that expertise.
So a new energy order is already altering global politics, and if it is, in what fundamental ways is this happening?
It's another element in the contemporary energy economy. I mean, one thing to really take away from this discussion, I hope you will, Paul, is that energy abundance is here. It's now. It's arrived, right? The old parsimonious habits where we would darn our socks, so to speak, you know, metaphorically, and really be careful about a limited resource, this is changing. And it's changing in an exponential way. The efficiencies of extracting oil and gas from shale are changing dramatically. If you look at the efficiencies of wells, there's a couple of examples from Pennsylvania where wells which are spudded in and starting the drill to actually producing well, the times in which that's taking now are dramatically quicker than they were even 4 years ago.
There's a big debate, of course, raging in this part of the world and others, but particularly here in Western Pennsylvania about fracking. What are your thoughts about it? Is it a bridge? Is it more than a bridge? Is it safe? Should we be doing it at all?
I think it's safe. I mean, one of the people to whom I look for guidance is the new Energy Secretary Moniz, and he, you know, guy from MIT, absolutely his own man. And the idea that he's some kind of, you know, a stand-in man for, you know, the fracking community is way off. This is a guy who's got his own opinions, and they're grounded in science and empirical result to an extent I'd never understand. But I follow his lead and others whom I respect, and he says that it's possible, not just possible, it is being done safely. There are issues relating to the tightness of the seal in some of these wells which are dug. But Arkansas itself, for example, shows the dramatic improvement in even efforts to try and find trace elements of methane in groundwater. They seem to be going ahead. I'm not saying everything's perfect, but I'm saying this is an industry which is very attentive to improving its efficiencies, to improving its rate, which is pretty good already, and not polluting. And it seems to me that the trend is pointing toward an improvement of that result.
We've got about a minute left. In 25 years from now, mm-hmm. if we're having this conversation, what are our cars running on? What are our cities powered by? What are the sources of energy?
Well, remember, neither am I a petroleum engineer or geologist nor transportation specialist. I'm a lawyer who spent an awful lot of his time getting shot at and
right.
and figuratively getting shot at in Washington for doing policy stuff relating to Asia. But I worked with a firm, Cambridge Energy Research Associates, for a long time. And so with that introduction, here's your answer. The answer is more of a mix than before. A lot of improvement in batteries, the hybridization of the light industrial fleet, and a lot more of the renewables, genuinely, with probably some pretty interesting breakthroughs in solar and wind coming down the road. So I think it's a time towards which we should look, and the idea that we're going to still be breathing this pall of choking smog as they are in Beijing, I think will be safely something of the past.
My guest has been James Clad, who serves as a consultant to energy and investment firms and is the Distinguished Research Fellow at the National Defense University. He previously served as the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Asian and Pacific Security Affairs. Mr. Clad is in Pittsburgh to address a World Affairs Council of Pittsburgh public policy discussion and luncheon tomorrow on the geopolitics of energy. The program will begin at noon at the Rivers Club in Pittsburgh. James Clad, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Paul. I've really enjoyed it.